Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Programme, the Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools, and we're here every Saturday at 12 noon to defend and promote public education. Let's just remind you, that's education that's public in purpose and outcome. Above all, it's public in access. It's open to all children, teachers, employees, etc. And as well as that, we believe that it should be publicly owned and controlled, because it's the only one that can be publicly accountable. And for that reason, for all those reasons, we also believe that it's the only one that should be publicly funded.
We've got some very interesting material for you to listen to in the next hour. Our Labor Party Education Minister here in Victoria has misrepresented the Gonski report on capital funding. And our friend up there in Canberra, Trevor Cobbald, has this to say about it. Let's hear from Andy.
Thanks, Jean. Ben Carroll misrepresents the Gonski report on capital funding. And this is an article by Trevor Cobbald published on April 5th. Ben Carroll's claim. Ben Carroll, Victorian Education Minister. When Gonski was first created many years ago, it was the recommendation from David Gonski that school infrastructure also be included in the equation when it comes to schooling resource standard. The Allan Labor government has spent $18.5 billion on school infrastructure. None of that is including the school resource standard. Except from the Gonski report, from the report summary. The schooling resource standard would form the basis for general recurrent funding for all students in all schooling sectors, consist of separate per student amounts for primary school students and secondary school students. To complement the recurrent schooling resource standard, there is need for an expanded stream of Australian government capital funding for both the government and non-government sectors. There is also a need for greater transparency and accountability for the condition of school infrastructure in Australia. This will be facilitated by the operation of the school planning authorities in each jurisdiction, as well as work by the National Schools Resourcing Body to develop expected standards to which buildings must be maintained and built, and greater monitoring and reporting on the condition of school infrastructure in all sectors and states. From the report, the resource standard proposed by the panel is a recurrent resource standard which includes a provision for general maintenance and minor acquisitions, such as computers and general equipment below established capitalisation thresholds, but does not include capital costs associated with debt servicing or the acquisition of fixed assets, such as land and buildings. Section 4.3.3 sets out the panel's proposed approach to funding capital through an expanded but separate stream of funding. In time, the development of a separate capital standard would complement the recurrent resource standard and guide government investment in school infrastructure. Recommendation 10. The schooling resource standard should be a recurrent resource standard, which includes a provision for general maintenance and minor acquisitions below an established capitalisation threshold, but does not include capital costs. Capital and infrastructure costs, other than maintenance and minor works, will not be funded through the recurrent schooling resource standard. The National Schools Resourcing Body will investigate the feasibility of a national capital resource standard and other cost benchmarking options to assist with future monitoring and design of capital expenditure programs. Conclusion. Clearly, Ben Carroll is misrepresenting the Gonski report. His claim is that David Gonski recommended capital expenditure be included in the SRS is totally incorrect. The SRS was only ever intended to apply to recurrent funding. The report specifically excluded capital expenditure from the SRS. The Gonski report supported the development of a separate standard for infrastructure. The Minister's claim is intended to deflect attention from the continuing massive underfunding of public schools in Victoria. Public schools are the most underfunded system in Australia, except for the Northern Territory. SOS estimates that Victorian public schools were underfunded by $2.1 billion in 2025 and $2.2 billion in 2026. The cumulative underfunding since 2018 amounts to about $16 billion. The continued underfunding of public schools is a barrier to reducing the vast inequity in school outcomes between rich and poor students. The lives of thousands of students are being blighted by the underfunding. Victoria is not the education state claimed by the Premier, Jacinta Allan, and her Education Minister. For example, the 2025 NAPLAN results show that 56.7% of Victorian Year 9 students whose parents did not complete Year 12 did not achieve the national reading standard, 55.6% did not achieve the writing standard, and 57.7% did not achieve the numeracy standard. In the case of Indigenous students, 52.6% did not achieve the reading standard, 56.9% did not achieve the writing standard, and 57.9% did not achieve the numeracy standard. In addition, large achievement gaps continue between advantaged and disadvantaged students. Low socioeconomic status and Indigenous students are 4 to 5 years behind high SES students in reading, writing, and numeracy. The Victorian Government should sign a new funding agreement with the Albanese Government to fully fund public schools by 2029. Instead of being the national laggard in funding public schools, it should live up to its education state motto and become the national standard bearer. And wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? Back to you, Jean.
Well, while we're talking about capital funding, and thank you very much for that, Andy, Dale is going to tell us about a group of parents up there in Collingwood who were dealing with roofs falling in their school. It's a shocking situation indeed. Over to you, Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Nicole Presell and Carolyn Shell. Chunks large enough to kill. Parents sound alarm on maintenance as school roof collapses. The roof of an inner-city school was leaking for years when the pressure finally became too much and a section caved in, sending potentially deadly chunks of concrete crashing into the classrooms below. It was only a quirk of the calendar that no one was hurt or even killed. The collapse, which occurred during the January school holidays while Collingwood College was empty, came after years of calls for urgent repairs to the building, which abuts the inner north suburbs' public housing towers. Families now want a thorough check of the whole building, saying temporary solutions have failed to fix the severe water damage, with the school council calling for urgent repairs since at least 2023. Parents believe schools are being left to rely on voluntary parent contributions or fundraising for necessities, including urgent repairs. Reports by the Victorian School Building Authority, the VSBA, in 2023, which took 2 years to be released, showed 1 in 5 Victorian public schools were in urgent need of repairs or rebuilding due to leaking roofs, cracked walls, or other faults. Collingwood College Council President Hannah Marshall, who has 2 children at the school, said the building's top level, which housed science labs, computer labs, an international student area, and the Year 10 student homerooms, has leaking roofs, metre-wide indoor puddles, and concrete so water-damaged it's crumbling. As the end of the school term nears, the floor remains closed. The VSBA conducts inspections at every Victorian public school at least once every 5 years, identifying urgent issues and ensuring students have safe access to learning spaces. But Marshall said the authority took so long to assess Collingwood College, the school community had to employ its own independent engineer. It's a pretty important, really well-used part of the school, Marshall said. It's not a lack of care from the school community. It's really just simply being asked to do too much. I don't think that Collingwood College will be alone in feeling like we're a bit neglected by the VSBA. Everybody should have a safe working and learning environment, she said. I think we don't see private schools being underfunded or having buildings like this. It's just unfair for our students to be asked and our teachers to be asked to work in these kinds of environments. Marshall said the school did so much from a parent perspective in boosting enrollments, the school community, and even registering for the International Baccalaureate for the middle years. She said the Collingwood school community was incredible and parents were good at fixing or making the best of things, but they felt they weren't being prioritised. Parent James Rankin said there'd been issues at the school since his son Sam, now in Year 10, started in Year 7. I love my school and I love the people who work there and the community, but I sometimes think, have I made the right choice for my kids, he said. Sam said the Year 10 students had to commute half an hour each way to the senior campus to use science labs, and the computer labs were also out of action, putting families who could not afford laptops for their children at further disadvantage. While the top floor remains closed, students have been crammed into two levels and accessing lockers has become difficult, with Sam choosing to carry all his belongings instead of trying to access his locker. It's become overwhelming. The students said there was also a smell from flooding and leaks, and when repair works were done, they were disruptive. James Rankin said that while he sat with his daughter during a parent-teacher interview, five buckets sat collecting water from the leaking ceiling in the classroom. They can't even get a leaky roof fixed, he said. Local Greens State MP Gabrielle De Vietri said when she visited the school in March, there were stalactites inside the ceiling where the water had been leaking for years, and concrete rubble on the floor from the collapsed ceiling. It terrified me, for the condition that this building was in and the risk that it could pose to students and teachers, and the whole floor is condemned, she said. Concrete from the roof is falling through the ceiling into the classrooms below, chunks large enough to seriously injure or even kill a student. De Vietri also said Spenceley Street Primary School in Clifton Hill was in dire need of new toilets. There's moss growing inside the walls. Some of the toilet doors don't shut. The tiles are falling off. The toilets don't flush properly. You've got teachers and the principal using plungers every single day just to get the pipes moving. This is not the way our school system should be. De Vietri said some schools got the promise of new facilities at election time, but other learning spaces are crumbling. David Nichols is on the school council at Spenceley Street Primary, and said the children's toilets had not been upgraded in 5 decades. The kids' toilets, they stink. Imagine 50 years of children's urine on lino, he said of the odour. The staff toilets were also absolutely appalling, Nichols said, and no one should have to deal with inadequate facilities. He noted that although Education Minister Ben Carroll visited the school and the VSBA had visited, the community was still waiting to find out about the upgrades. No one wants to cut a ribbon in front of a toilet block, he said. In response to questions, an Education Department spokesperson said the VSBA was working with the school to evaluate the conditions of the toilets and to identify any remediation actions that might be required. Australian Education Union Victorian Branch President Justin Mullaly said staff, students and support staff had the right to a safe teaching and learning environment. Mould in classrooms or staff facilities and other serious health and safety risks are completely unacceptable and must be addressed immediately before anyone is injured or becomes unwell. He said the state government must continue to provide adequate maintenance resources and funding to replace buildings that weren't fit for purpose. One way to provide for the infrastructure needs of public schools is for the government to stop allocating hundreds of millions of dollars for private school enhancements, as they have done in recent years, Mullaly said. A Department Education spokesperson said the safety of students and staff at Collingwood College was paramount, but it acknowledged the closure in the main building was disruptive for the school community. We have made alternate learning arrangements for Year 10 students, and an alternative modular classroom will be in place for further science classes by early May 2026, they said. A project to resolve leaks coming from the roof is underway and due for completion by the end of this month. We are working with structural engineers to plan a full remediation for the roof, and timelines for completion will then be shared with the Collingwood College school community as soon as possible. That's disgraceful. Back to you, Jean.
Well, of course, all the money that should be going to the state schools is going out the other end to the private schools. And they don't have to worry about roofs falling in, and they certainly don't have to worry about their bank balances if they are in the upper echelons of principalships, or I think they call them executives these days. Let's hear from Andy again.
Thanks, Jean. the Sydney private schools, where teams of executives earned $5 million plus. And this was published in the Fairfax Press on April 1st. Two Sydney private schools are now spending more than $5 million per year to pay large teams of executives to run the institutions. Newington paid its team of 19 key managers $5.3 million, while Pymble Ladies College gave its 15-member executive team a total of $5.3 million, according to 2024 financial statements filed with the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission. The rising management costs come as private school fees have ballooned by thousands of dollars a year, which principals and school boards say is necessitated by increased staffing costs as teacher wages have grown. The financial data of 48 schools across Sydney shows 13 schools reported remuneration for key management personnel increased by $500,000 or more between 2023 and 2024. A further 15 schools saw the total pay packets of their management teams grow by at least $100,000 in 12 months. At 9 schools, the amount paid to key management personnel declined, with the payment of long service leave and staff turnover in some cases influencing the total. Cranbrook had the largest average amount paid to management in 2024, but its figures were distorted by a payment to a former key manager, which its financial report said was subject to a confidential deed. Its former head, Nicholas Sampson, departed the institution in 2024. St Catherine's School in Waverley, Riverview and Shaw all paid more than $4 million per year to managers. A St Catherine's spokesman said it reflected a period of restructure and change across its school and the education sector. Management pay information has been publicly available since 2022 following a shake-up of charity rules. Reported figures relate to senior decision-makers in an organisation. Some schools recorded two managers, while several others had teams of more than a dozen. Skeggs Redlands had 21 in 2024, an increase of 10 people on the previous year, which a spokeswoman said reflected those closely involved in the management of the school. Public school principals make up to $236,318 a year. A spokesman for Independent Schools New South Wales said that private school pay reflected enhanced responsibilities, qualifications and skills required to manage organisations turning over millions of dollars every year. The New South Wales Education Standards Authority said schools must demonstrate a clear and documented rationale for their remuneration decisions. Skeggs Darlinghurst Principal Holly Guyton said an additional staff manager, salary increases for all staff and additional superannuation costs had driven up the amount paid to managers. Scott James, headmaster of Knox Grammar, where total management remuneration fell, said remuneration is set in line with responsibilities and sector benchmarks, and pay rates themselves have not declined. Education Minister Jason Clare said every dollar that schools spend must support the education of students. I think it's fair enough that if parents are paying school fees, they deserve to know how much principals are being paid, he said. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much, Andy, for enlightening us on the extraordinary inequality in our education situation in Australia. The inequality between the private and the public sector is outstanding and quite frightening. But it's no wonder, of course, that the teacher unions and the teachers themselves, they're pushing their union representatives into having a say about all of this. And they were out in the streets in their tens of thousands in the last weeks, and they're thinking of doing it again. Over to Sorrel.
Thanks, Jean. This article is written by Noel Towell and is entitled Teachers' Union Prepares for Further Industrial Action in Term 2. Teachers in Victoria's government schools are preparing to take further strike action as they continue to fight the state government for better pay and working conditions. The proposal put to educators is for classrooms to shut for half-day strikes when school returns for term two after the Easter school holidays. But some members of the Australian Education Union, the AEU, want to go further and stage a repeat of last month's statewide stoppage that brought 34,500 teachers, principals and support workers onto the streets of Melbourne for a mass protest on March 24th. As schools across Victoria prepare to close their gates on Thursday for 2 weeks of Easter holidays, The state government said on Wednesday it wants to keep wage talks with the AEU going throughout the break. But the two sides remain far apart, with the AEU asking for a 35% pay increase over 3 years and the government offering 17% with a 1.5% overtime allowance. An AEU council of 120 workplace delegates from primary and secondary schools across Victoria has authorised a rolling campaign of strikes and work bans to schools after they return from the Easter holidays if the government does not come forward with an acceptable offer. The fresh walkouts would hit one of the state's 17 school districts, which range in scale between 50 and 150 schools, teaching between 9,000 and 75,000 students at a time. But the union has not communicated where and when the stoppages might begin. Teachers would also refuse to attend meetings or respond to emails from the Department of Education and impose a ban on writing comments on semester report cards to parents. Putting the motion to the Council of Representatives, the AEU's State Branch President, Justin Mullaly, said the union had no choice but to escalate its industrial actions. The failure of the Allan government to properly value and respect the work of AEU members and their continuing failure to properly fund Victoria's public schools means there is no alternative but to enable actions to be put in place to further escalate our campaign, Mullaly wrote in his motion to the council. But some union members want to go further still. Encouraged by the success of last month's strike, the teachers at some schools are pushing for further 24-hour strikes in term two, along with a total ban on producing reports. An attempt by the educators to get the council to vote for more drastic action was unsuccessful, but they have not given up, writing a follow-up motion that the mood in some staff rooms was growing more militant. Limiting our industrial campaign to work bans and half-day regional strikes will not be as impactful as the statewide 24-hour strike we have taken on 24th of March, the unionists wrote. Sub-branches that have passed motions supporting at least 24 hours stop works include Keilor Downs College, Virtual School Victoria, Fitzroy High School, The Pavilion, and more. There is an appetite for serious escalation. Education Minister Ben Carroll said on Wednesday that department officials were working hard to find a settlement that would avoid the need for more strikes. The union and the Department of Education are meeting 3 times a week this week, including an all-day meeting, the minister said. I've made it very clear to the union I want to continue to negotiate through the school holiday period as well. We are very committed to getting a good, fair deal done for what I think are the best teachers in the nation. Now, back over to you, Jean.
Well, if you want to find out more about the teachers' union's action, of course, you can listen to our podcast of a couple of weeks ago. But and that's on the 3CR Dogs website. But we're going to have a bit of a break now.
3CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
you're still listening to the Dogs program, because Dale has found a very interesting article from the ABC, which we thought you'd be very interested in. Now, the Dogs believe in education being free, secular, and available for all children from the time they are born to the time they leave university, and for that matter, till the time they die. But because you can always keep learning. But our universities, unfortunately, certainly under the Labor Party, under the Hawke government, Dawkins as the Minister for Education, started to believe that somehow it would be really good if they privatised our universities, or at least made them fee-paying. They introduced HECS for our home students, but they started charging fees for international students. And, oh, haven't they been rolling around in their billions? Very interesting what has happened to their administrations. But sometimes you can get too greedy. And there's a question as to whether or not Australia's university empire is losing its global appeal. Over to Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Damien Cave for ABC's Long Read. Is Australia's university empire losing global appeal? A generation ago, studying in Australia opened doors. Today, rising costs and falling satisfaction are making international students think twice and locals feel sidelined. In the hallways of a hotel in downtown Ho Chi Minh City, a series of posters show the smiling faces of Vietnamese professionals now leading companies in academic fields they had studied in Australia. A software baron, a banker specialising in mergers, a renewable energy pioneer, and more. Many of the graduates were there for the first meeting of a new group called the Australian Alumni Business Network. Decades after studying at universities from Sydney to Perth, I saw some of them throwing their arms around each other for photos. I shook hands with another, his eyes bright with excitement as he caught me reading his poster. And as we all moved into the conference room, it was not hard to hear and feel Australian soft power in the stories of these executive class alumni. Many described feeling enormously grateful to Canberra for making Australia's universities accessible and affordable. Mostly middle-aged, they usually went with scholarships and left with strong connections. We saw a lot of opportunity for ourselves and to contribute to both countries, our mother country Vietnam and also Australia, said Fung Van Dong, a successful software entrepreneur. Dong's backstory was familiar. Since I moved from Sydney to Vietnam, I've often run across people who studied in Australia, and I've been thrilled by every discovery and the chance to trade impressions. But as Dong and I spoke after the event, it was hard not to wonder if his positive experience still represented the norm for international students, or whether the power of education to burnish Australia's image has been endangered by the transformation of many Australian universities into what critics now see as massive corporatised degree factories. The sandstone towers of Australian intellectual life have undeniably become global case studies in swollen enrolment. The University of Sydney more than doubled student numbers in a generation, mostly with Chinese arrivals paying hefty fees. Nearly half of the university's income came from the international students in 2022. Education is now a successful export industry worth about $54 billion, as Australians well know. Money, money, money is the chorus oft repeated, as if revenue from overseas is a gift, a pokies payout that keeps Australians from having to contribute more for the same education they've always received. But is it the same education, or has the quality of Australia's university experience been getting worse for years for students both foreign and domestic? Professors who see what's going on try to unpack what disturbs them. To sum up, the problems they reveal include 3/4 of a class that won't show up in person, scores of students who can barely speak English, and the fact that cheating is big business and rampant, soon to be made worse by artificial intelligence. The integrity of the entire system is at risk, a veteran professor at the University of Sydney told me, insisting on anonymity to avoid angering his bosses. It needs remedial attention. The trade-offs that came with expansion, the impacts on quality, the way some universities are run with a business-first, education-second ethos, makes teaching feel like an afterthought, alienating students and professors while losing the world's best and brightest to institutions with better faculty-student ratios and more school spirit. Well, unsurprisingly, that has all been difficult for politicians and chancellors to honestly discuss. But as a reporter, I can tell you that evidence for concern is there. Worldwide, the reputation of the average Australian university is declining as others rise in appeal. Asian universities are improving and expanding. British, Canadian, Dutch, and even some American universities cost the same or less for international students, giving them plenty of options. Many of these universities earn higher ratings for social, career, and teacher support. Meanwhile, student satisfaction in Australia has been stuck below the global average for years. More granular survey data of both domestic and international students shows that universities with some of the largest international student cohorts from just one or two countries are at the bottom of national rankings for satisfaction. Add it all up and an uncomfortable truth starts to coalesce from the data and interviews. At a time of global disruption, when the government has insisted that Australia's future depends on its regional relationships, universities, the country's institutional powerhouses of opportunity and global connection, are mired in a crisis of quality and it's not that bad denial. Second rate and too expensive. A lifestyle gem of overpriced mediocrity. That's how the young strivers of Asia increasingly describe Australia's universities and Australia. For how long are Australians willing to accept such an abysmal grade? The Albanese government has acknowledged problems, especially at a handful of bigger universities and at the lower end of vocational education, where visa fraud has run rampant. In 2024, roughly 73% of international revenue for universities across New South Wales came from 3 countries, China, India, and Vietnam. At 6 universities, China was the leading source, and at the University of Sydney and University of New South Wales, nearly 80% of international education income came from Chinese students alone, according to the state's Auditor General. Experts and officials say many of the largest universities with the strongest influence on Australian and global opinion have been slow to change, and the problems that come with what Hannah Forsyth, a historian of Australian education, has called the enshittification of the system stretch beyond national borders. Universities, after all, are more than just exporters. They are frontline, multi-year ambassadors, shaping how overseas communities feel about Australia for decades to come. Lost in the dispute over visas and budgets is the importance of that interaction, the student experience, that touches more foreign lives more deeply than anything that is Australian. There are at least 160,000 alumni of Australian universities in Vietnam alone, and there's a pretty clear relationship between time and gratitude. The further back the degree, the greater the appreciation for Australia. The more recent, the more those reviews are mixed at best.
I'm going to have to leave that there because the article is quite long, but it does go on to explain how evaluating universities on a purely business basis, devoid of broader values like social good, democracy, cohesion, international goodwill, and soft power, destroys the opportunities for truly rich cultural exchanges, valuable interpersonal relationships, and international diplomatic relations that were once inherent on our university campuses. So go along to the ABC's long read of April 5th and read Damien Cave's article. It's worth it. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much for all that, Dale. And now we've got our roaming expert, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. And today this comes from Jeff Bryant, who's a well-known education analyst and American educator. This article actually appeared in the Asia Times. The article begins, September 2023, Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis stunned school choice advocates when he kicked out four private schools from the state school's voucher program. The school's offence, according to the state's announcement, was the direct ties to the Chinese Communist Party, which was seen as an imminent threat to health, safety and welfare of these schools, students and the public. The alleged ties were not explained in the announcement. What was surprising about the announcement was that Florida has long been regarded as number one in education freedom by school choice advocates, and its largely unregulated voucher market, along with those of other states, has been described as the Wild West of school voucher expansions. For those who don't know, school voucher is the American version of a way of funding private schools. A report on the state's announcement by WFTV explained that the governor's decision was likely due to the for-profit owner of these schools, Spring Education Group, controlled by Primavera Holdings Limited, which is a reference to Primavera Capital, a private equity investment firm based in Hong Kong. Spring Education Group is one of the largest operators of private schools in the US, overseeing more than 200 schools in 19 states. The company's schools are considered prestigious and include Stratford School, LaPorte Montessori Schools, Noble Learning Communities, and Basis Independent Schools. In a written statement to WFTV, spokespersons representing the four Florida schools banned from the voucher program stated, "We are regularly acknowledged as one of the best private schools in our area and have a track record of delivering outstanding educational outcomes, which is why parents choose us. Our schools are locally run, abide by local, state and federal laws, and do not have ties to any government or political party." Nevertheless, when the New York Post, a conservative tabloid owned by the right-wing firebrand Rupert Murdoch, caught wind of this story from Florida, it reported that a group of elite private schools in Manhattan and Brooklyn, operated by Basis Independent Schools, were sold to Spring Education Group in 2019. Primavera's chairman and CEO has previously been named as one-time senior member of the Chinese Communist Party. The article further said that while Basis Schools tells parents in a disclaimer that its parent company, Spring Education Group, is controlled by Primavera, which it says is itself owned by Chinese persons residing in Hong Kong, the schools do not acknowledge the communist link. Primavera disputes that Hugh is currently a Communist Party member. But concerns about Spring Education Group and Primavera continue to be a flashpoint among conservative lawmakers and advocates in other states. In February 2024, Republican U.S. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas wrote a high-profile letter to the then-US Secretary Lloyd Austin, expressing concerns about another company associated with Primavera Capital called Tutor.com. Tutor.com is a long-standing provider of tutoring services to our service members and families, Cotton wrote, and its acquisition by a Chinese-owned corporation, along with the Princeton Review in 2022, concerned him. Tutor.com collects personal data on users, the senator said, such as location, internet protocol addresses and contents of the tutoring sessions. That business arrangement, Cotton maintained, was akin to paying to expose our military and their children's private information to the Chinese Communist Party. Cotton's letter quickly caught the attention of multiple right-wing advocacy groups. In March 2024, Parents Defending Education, a conservative astroturf organisation that accuses public schools and universities of spreading transgender ideology and liberal indoctrination, issued a non-exhaustive list of school districts that give students access to Tutor.com. In 2025, Parents Defending Education rebranded to Defending Education. The New York Post promptly amplified the concerns of Parents Defending Education, reporting that Tutor.com was assisting the Chinese government in infiltrating American classrooms. Picking up the New York Post's conspiratorial language, another conservative group of critical of public schools, Freedom in Education, uncovered, in inverted commas, evidence of Tutor.com facilitating infiltration of Chinese spyware in schools in Georgia. By December 2025, it was no longer clear if Primavera divested from Twitter.com or still owned shares, according to the Washington Free Beacon, a right-wing media site funded by billionaire Paul Singer, a hedge fund manager and major donor to the Republican political candidates. But pointing to the connection between Primavera and Spring Education Group, the article stated, there are also signs of China's new approach to the influencing elementary and high schools just by the school's expansion of groups like Spring Education into the American educational landscape comes as American youth are increasingly open to far-left socialist economic ideology, as evidenced by the election of New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani. Oh, these culture war things keep going. Also in December, another news outlet in the right-wing media echo chamber, Texas Scorecard, warned readers of Primavera's connections to the Spring Education Group and its ownership of 13 schools in the Lone Star State. The article was published around the time Texas debuted a $1 billion school voucher program. In other states, which like Florida have largely unregulated school voucher programs, state tax dollars are already flowing to private schools operated by Spring Education Group. In North Carolina, Spring Education Group operates 8 schools, 2 of which are participating in the state's voucher program. The other 6 are preschool only, which are ineligible for North Carolina voucher money. These 2 schools, Chesterbrook Academy Elementary and Middle School in Cary and Chesterbrook Academy Preschools and Elementary in Raleigh, received $106,000 and $49,000 respectively in public funds in the 2024-25 school year, according to state government reporting. Yet despite the conservative movement's fears about Chinese communist influence in the American education system, many red state officials and advocacy groups are opting into a new federal program created by the Trump administration that may lead to huge financial payouts to education companies like Spring Education Group and Tutor.com, and in turn their private investors, including Primavera Capital. Who is Hugh? Conservative rumours about ties between Primavera and its founder, Fred Hu, who also goes by Fred Zulu Hu and Zhu Lui Hu on English language sites, to the Chinese Communist Party have some basis in fact. According to multiple websites, including Chinese ones that our schools translated into English with the help of researchers, an individual named Hu Zulu, Fred Hu, served multiple terms from 2008 through at least 2023 as a delegate in the Hunan Province Provincial Committee of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, CPPCC, economic sector. According to CPPCC's official website, the CPPCC is an organisation in the Patriotic United Front of the Chinese People, an important organ for multi-party cooperation and political consultation under the leadership of the Communist Party of China, CPC, and an important means of promoting socialist democracy in China's political activities. In 2008, Hu Zulu was elected as a member of the 10th Hunan Provincial Committee of the CPCC, and in 2013 he was re-elected as a member of the 11th CPCC, according to Primavera Capital's Chinese language website. The Berggruen Institute, a Los Angeles-based think tank founded in 2010 by investor philanthropist Nicholas Berggruen, describes Hu as having advised the Chinese government. Hu's Columbia Business School bio describes him as the founder of Primavera Capital and partner at Goldman Sachs Group, who also served as the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., and has advised the Chinese government on financial reform and macroeconomic policies. An archive page from Primavera's previous website describes Chunhua Capital Primavera's native name as founded by Dr. Hu Zulu, a renowned economist and financial expert. Dr. Hu previously served as a partner and chairman of the Greater China at Goldman Sachs, snooping on students. Republican concerns about Primavera's involvement with Chinese government surveillance technology appears to have some validity. The financial group appears to have a penchant for investing in companies heavily involved in surveillance tech. According to Bloomberg, Primavera was one of 8 cornerstone investors that committed to subscribe for $450 million in shares of Chinese artificial intelligence company SenseTime Group, Inc. In December 21, SenseTime was placed on the US Treasury Department's investment blacklist for its role in surveillance technology deployed for monitoring ethnic Uyghur populations in the Xinjiang region in Western China. As the Washington Post reported, the Treasury Department, which oversees the investment prohibition list, said SenseTime has developed facial recognition programs that can determine the target's ethnicity, with a particular focus on identifying ethnic Uyghurs, a persecuted Muslim minority population in China, and used digital surveillance technology to track Uyghurs' movements and activities to create a police state in the Xinjiang region. China's repression of Uyghurs, a Muslim ethnic minority group, was seen as a crime against humanity by the UN, Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, in 2022. Another artificial intelligence company that Primavera has invested in, which has been accused of developing highly invasive surveillance technology, is Palantir. In May 25, the New York Times reported that the Trump administration was spending hundreds of millions of federal dollars to install Palantir's Foundry operating system in multiple federal agencies to compile a master list of personal information on Americans that could give the president untold surveillance power. According to an article in The Conversation by Nicole Bennett, who described herself as a researcher who studies in the intersection of data governance, digital technologies in the US federal government, the Trump administration has employed another Palantir operating system called Gotham. Gotham, the article said, is an investigative platform built for police, national security agencies, public health departments and other state clients to take whatever data an agency already has, break it down into its smallest components and then connect the dots. To be clear, no one has accused Spring Education Group of snooping on our students. The company's privacy notice states, we do not make your personal information available to purchase or otherwise share your information with third parties in exchange for monetary compensation. However, privacy advocates, parents and teachers are expressing growing concerns about how edtech company platforms in schools collect and use student data and how that use constitutes a breach in student and educator privacy. So Primavera's interest in both education and surveillance as hot investment properties is bound to raise questions. Any politician viewed as steering public funds to bad actors in the student privacy debate is likely to become a target for criticism. Look, I'll leave the article there, but it is quite the story of infiltration, espionage and education all being tied together in a knot. And with that, I'm going to pass you back to the headquarters of the Dogs and wish you well for the weekend and have a lovely one. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff. And, you know, perhaps the thought for the week is if you try to privatise education, well, then it's fair game for anyone to take over. So we're going to have a break here and come back for our good news.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope. Only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au. Let's cook.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855am. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program because this is the best sector. That's always the last. And we have a really nice piece for you here about dogs. If you're a dog person, I think you'll like it. Over to Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Caitlin Cassidy, Dog-Eared Page Turners, How Tashi and 388 Other Canines Are Helping Australian Children to Read. They love pats, don't judge, and they let you go at your own pace, perfect for instilling confidence and letting kids associate pleasure with reading. Tashi sits on the couch of a primary school library in Sydney with a 7-year-old student. For the next 20 minutes, Harlow, a Bondi Public School student, will read to her, sounding out words slowly and giggling at the pictures of Pig the Pug looking very stinky. Once Harlow is finished, 5 more children, each with a dedicated 20-minute slot of one-on-one time to practice their reading skills with Tashi, follow. There is nothing unusual about this scenario, except for the fact that Tashi is a 10-year-old miniature poodle. Tashi is one of 389 dogs across Australia that are part of a literacy program called Story Dogs, which help primary school students gain the confidence and ability to read aloud.
It's their non-judgmental nature that makes canines the perfect companions for children who may feel anxious reading to a group, have additional learning needs, or don't have opportunities to read regularly at home, says Story Dogs co-founder Janine Sigley. The dogs are accompanied by their owners, who volunteer to help children sound out difficult words and build relationships with the students. Meanwhile, the dog will sit patiently, accept pats, and act as a friendly, accepting face. For children who have ADHD or learning difficulties, they can take a breath, take their time, gently stroke the dog, and go at their own pace, Sigley says. Education systems can put a lot of pressure on young people to be able to read, and if they don't get it straight away, they get extremely anxious. This way, they can make mistakes, and it's okay. And the children then want to do the best they can for the dog. They form this really strong bond, and they actually go home and practice. The program was established by Sigley and Leah Sheldon in regional New South Wales in 2009 in response to concerns over wide disadvantage gaps in literacy among young children who just hadn't got that start in life. It is modelled on a similar program that operates in the US using dogs as education assistance animals and has grown to operate in every state and territory apart from the Northern Territory. It's the association of pleasure with reading. The latest NAPLAN results show 4 in 10 students perform below expectations in grammar and punctuation, indicating they struggle to recognise verbs and pronouns in sentences. 1 in 3 students are still falling behind benchmarks in reading and spelling. Sue Bogner discovered the program after realizing Tashi, a miniature poodle who was 5 years old when she adopted her, was very special, a perfect combination of placid and loving. She contacted Bondi Public School 3 years ago, where her 2 grandchildren attend, and it is now the only primary school in Sydney which has story dogs. At 9 a.m. every Friday, she arrives with Tashi in tow. They read for about 2 hours before the dog gets a bit past it, says Tashi's owner, Sue Bogner. It's the association of pleasure with reading, she says. If we can do that, then we've achieved a lot. With Tashi by her side, Harlow reads Pig the Grub, a tale about an extremely dirty dog. She sounds out words slowly, receiving assistance with the tricky pronunciation of hygiene. Do you know what hygiene is? Bogner asks. It's how you keep clean. Conversation turns to Tashi's hygiene and the penchant of dogs for rolling around in poop. My dog only rolled in poop once, Harlow said, smiling cheekily. Now she never does. Bogner, who worked in the education system and as a librarian for 50 years before retiring, says reading in front of a whole class can be pretty scary. It's such a special thing to help students become competent with their reading, because if they're not really confident by the end of year 2, it just gets harder and harder for them, she says. Dogs love everyone. They don't judge, they don't complain, and that's wonderful. Once the 2 hours are up, Tashi makes a move to leave before being swarmed by adoring children delighted to be able to pat the story dog. Asked if Bogner thinks her pet is aware of her fame, she muses, no, she doesn't need to be a star. She doesn't become big-headed. She's just very caring and happy to do whatever. It's not often you get someone in your life like that. Back to you, Jean.
Well, it won't be hard for you to guess what is our great state school of the week, but here is Andy with it.
Thanks, Jean. And this week's great state school of the week is Bondi Beach Public School. Bondi Beach Public School is a kindergarten to year 6 comprehensive co-educational primary school in Bondi, Sydney. We are proud to be part of a strong public education system and welcome students from all backgrounds and cultures. Our vision, where kindness is championed and everyone perseveres to succeed. Our school facilities, we offer a range of learning environments. They help students to stay engaged, build confidence, and enjoy every part of their school day. Our Bondi Public School facilities include bright and comfortable classrooms, a well-stocked library for reading and research, science labs for hands-on experiments, sports fields for fitness and fun, art and music and performances spaces for creative learning. Resources and technology. Bondi Public School uses modern technology and digital learning tools. Our resources help students learn, create, and stay connected. As a New South Wales public school, we have access to shared programs and tools available to all schools in the state. There's always something to celebrate at Bondi Public School, from exciting events to proud moments and everyday wins. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The school has 348 students. 34% of students have a language background other than English, and 1% are of Indigenous heritage. The ICSIA value is quite high at 1,120. This means 48% of students have parents in the upper 25% of incomes, 34% in the next quartile, 14% in the third quartile, just below 50%, and 5% in the lowest quartile of parental incomes. It costs the taxpayer $17,872 to educate a student at this school. The school receives $1.27 million from the federal government and $4.86 million from the state government, $184,000 from fees and $467,000 from private fundraising. Only $1.07 million was received for capital grants in the last 3 years. The NAPLAN results are fine, and this school also boasts many extracurricular activities. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to the Bondi Beach Public School. And if you want to hear out more of the dogs, then you can go to our 3CR website and listen to our podcasts, or go to our website at www.adogs.info. But our time has gone, and it's up to me now to thank our wonderful producer Dale and her offsider Andy and Sol and Jeff. And from all of us here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air.
Over five decades, we've been home to hundreds of shows, thousands of broadcasters and guests, and hundreds of thousands of listeners.
This February, we're aiming for 1,000 subscribers.
It's just $40 concession, $80 full.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
3CR.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au and thanks for your support.